This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 220, Holding Out for Tan. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemechek. We'll be talking about some of the recent news that came out of Star Trek Las Vegas, including Patrick Stewart's return to the franchise as Jean-Luc Picard, the maturation of CBS and its approach to Star Trek, casting troubles with the next Kelvin timeline film, Star Trek Discovery's physical media release, and all the changes in store for the show in Season 2, including yet another redesign of the Klingons. So let's step into the Ready Room. Well, Larry, fancy meeting you again here in the Ready Room. I see that you have returned from your big con adventures in San Diego and Las Vegas.
Yes, Chris. I made it through just fine. Didn't stop by the nickel slots or anything, and I'm all here but my voice. No, I'm kidding. I totally
right.
Kidding.
Well, that's because you're not doing things like we used to do when we were producing CDs and you were recording the intros in the bar in Las Vegas at night the day before the convention.
That was only because it was a tour year, Chris, which is next year, which I want to do a shout out to eventually. But no, this was. Yes, my mantra this year has at both big cons has been simpler but smarter.
Right.
So,
well, I once again, as usual, could not make it to Star Trek Las Vegas. A lot of big things happened, and we're going to talk about some of those today. Of course, Patrick Stewart returning to the franchise. We've got some news about Star Trek IV, which I'm going to call Kelvin IV, and also Discovery, but. Before we talk about these in detail, I want to hear your overall impressions of what happened in Las Vegas as someone who was there on the floor.
The big memory that you will have, that people will have, is if they were in the room when the poll Alex Kurtzman, Patrick Stewart announcement happened. Now, because they had been saying cryptically all morning, oh, Alex Kurtzman's going to make a special announcement at the end of the Shatner panel. Well, I didn't hear it. The one time I heard this, someone said Adam, meaning Adam Malin from Creation, is going to make a big announcement. And he introduced Alex, who introduced Patrick. You know, it was a surprise. And I thought they were just going to announce something about the Creation, future conventions. You know, they renewed the deal. They didn't renew their deal or something like that. And I was at my table. But it's really funny. The rest of the day, I had like this tsunami of when they opened the doors and people came running out, and they ran back into the dealer room, which is now the vendor's room or the exhibition hall, whatever. I had so many people running up to tell me all about it breathlessly. I knew it was going to be on all, channels of social media, officially, unofficially, hand cameras, whatever, within a moment. People were so excited and thrilled. But the first thing that hit me, we can talk about this later, was, oh, because I had just tweeted last week, they didn't wheel Patrick out at Comic-Con. They're sure not going to do it at Vegas, reflecting the past corporate, use of the cons.
You're talking about media, about getting the biggest bang for your buck in terms of broader publicity.
I'm thinking about how CBS has shown they think.
Yeah, true.
The last couple of years.
Right.
And And so that it wasn't me. I was just noticing what they did and going, okay, this is the way they think. And so that was a shift. We can talk about that later. But just the excitement level, people were kind of bopping off the walls. Seasoned old grizzled veterans, all the Trek FM and the Roddenberry podcast people I knew, everybody who had been around the block a couple of times it was good to see everybody giddy about something. Just, you know, the average fans, I heard later on. The other thing was that I went to circles and it was kind of the, you know, after all the years of saying, where were you for Pearl Harbor, or JFK, or 9/11?
Right. Challenger explosion. I remember that one so well.
Yeah, Challenger explosion. It was a bit on the order of where were you when Apollo 11 landed and Neil Armstrong took his breath. It was a little bit of where were you when Patrick came out and they announced it, just in that microcosm of a few hours, that day, as apparently hashtag Patrick Stewart and hashtag Captain Picard were melting down Twitter, actually, which was awesome. And to hear people, and one guy, I was at my table, I'm telling my story, people were telling me stories. One of my Portal 47ers, Marina, who's a big con goer, was talking about noticing to her side 30 CBS people coming in with their CBS badges, sitting down, and she's like, oh, this is going to be, something's going on big, and seeing all of them whip up their own personal phones. That's just one thing. But later, talking to another guy, I said, well, I was in the All-American Grill, for anybody listening that knows the Rio. It's what I call it, the Denny's of the Rio. It's owned by the hotel. And people were, because it was, they were having lunch, because it was like 1-ish in the afternoon, local there. And this gentleman said, nope, I was in having lunch. But I was reading Twitter, and I was the first person I know to see it. And I jumped up, and he's like, I've got 80 or 100 people all eating at tables around me. And I said, guess what, everybody? The next Star Trek is going to be a Picard show with Patrick. And he said, so I wasn't in the room, but I got to be the guy that all those people remember as the guy that told them when they heard the news. So, you know, that was the kind of after. It just lifted all boats of excitement. And, of course, my mind went to, well, we've been waiting for this for 2 months. But the rest of the convention, you know, the ostensible initial push of the theme of the weekend was the 25th of DS9. That's a little show. Have you ever seen DS9, Chris?
I've heard of it. Yeah. Yeah, people talk about it sometimes.
It's a lovely little show. You ought to see it sometime.
All right. Maybe I'll give it a try sometime.
They had a lot of news and fun and big panels. And then Discovery had always planned to be there. And Discovery was a major factor this time. But I really got the sense with having three stages now, the small stage, and my stellar cartography coming out. So CBS was cordial enough to have me on two or three of the official stages, aside from our other work that we do. But no, it really was getting to the point where it's starting to finally feel like you can't get all your arms around the whole convention anymore. It's not like you can go, well, there's the big things on the main stage, but there's lots of filler time. And, you know, and the secondary stage is not feeling very secondary. They really, I said this 6 or 8 years ago, CBS was starting to Comic-Conify Vegas, as in getting licensees to come up and bring their designers and creators to talk about comics and the games and online and whatever else creatively is going on, the authors, some of the other interesting, you know, projects that are going on. And Roddenberry's doing more of that. There's just lots of good stuff. And part of that, of course, is driven by the fact there's a show on the air. We're not in the fallow years anymore, which people forget that. But no, I was really shocked at how the 50th, they expanded from 4 to 5 days, and Wednesday is still kind of an empty-ish day. But then the next year, rather than pull back, it became the holding day. It was very convenient to dump all the fresh Discovery last minute.
Right.
Okay, we have enough here we can talk about live with people and bring these faces out live. And then I went, well, okay. And this year it was a combination of the 25th for DS9. And now Discovery's been on the air and we can talk about it. And people are even more so. And the Discovery cosplay and the creative old Trek cosplay. So the whole thing just felt like there's no retrenching. And you think the 50th was big in 2016 and then last year was big. It's just gotten, it's not San Diego Comic Con. That's 180,000 people. This is still 10, 15, 18,000, whatever it is. And there were times when the vendors' room felt very comfortable. You weren't crammed. But there was more programming to see than ever before. And even without the Patrick news on Saturday, the first few days had been building. A lot of new faces. I continuously met in just the small days, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I just personally talked to at least 12 or 15 people, you know, coming to the table or just meeting them somewhere in line, whatever. Met 12 or 15 Vegas rookies. I kept meeting new Okies, which was amazing to me. It's like, wow. So, and I didn't know them when I'm back home for local fandom in SoonerCon. But no, it was just a really, I mean, some of the vendors, I think, thought that sales were down a little bit. But like our friend Lou Halbeth at Fansets said before Saturday, of all their pins, and they have a zillion of them, just as one case study here that's famous now, he said, you know, we sold about 6 or 7 Picard pins before Saturday afternoon. And after that moment, we sold 40.
I thought you were going to say sold 4,000. Now everybody wants a Picard pin.
They didn't bring that many. No, and I just think that the fan empowerment, I said this on Trekline Tuesdays Live this week. I really think the fan empowerment year by year by year is just incredible. More meetups, more people organizing groups. Somebody said, I think the fandom that has utilized social media the best, and there were a lot of comparisons with Star Wars and some of the, you know, actors and writers that have ducked Twitter or gotten off completely. And even though we've had our, you know, sad kind of the hate fringe in Trek, or just the obstinate, not, you know, not critiquing, but they don't know what critiquing is. It's just an all or nothing shoot from the hip. But that seems like it's touched Star Trek smaller than the other franchises. And Star Trek has found a way to, like, organizing groups and events for Vegas on Facebook and Twitter and doing that. And one last thing. Somebody brought this up. I think it was John Champion talking early at our landing party Tuesday night or something about he'd been talking to a bartender somewhere in the Rio, because there's two or three little ones and all, and talking about how the Rio has the World Series of Poker for 4, 5, 6 weeks every year, right before Vegas, Trek Vegas. And then they have Trek Vegas. And that's their two biggest events of the year. And although Trek Vegas is basically a week, a long week, you know, maybe 10 days, but people coming early and leaving, or the vendors coming early and leaving. But they said that employees at the Rio said they look forward to Trek Vegas week every year because the Trek people are the nicest people they see all year long. And I heard that. And yeah, and then I would do my own little poll. I would, you know, somebody who's in the little market, or another bartender, or a waitress, or the guy working at the FedEx, UPS, copying and freight store. And this guy went, had to do a banner, a replacement banner, because our Geek Nation Tours banner didn't come. So I did like an 11 by 17 mini banner to stick on my banner. And he helped me, you know, bring it out. He sat there and played with it in Photoshop. And there wasn't a line. And I said, thank you so much. Thank you so much for helping me extra. And he said, anything for the Trek people. This is the best week of the year here. I didn't even prompt him. And that's just the general vibe. I mean, you know, the little things happen. People, you know, I didn't hear of a great con crud epidemic this year afterwards. Maybe some folks did. But anyway, it was just, it just feels like it's building. So we'll see. I think most folks had a great time, even apart from the news.
Well, Larry, speaking of those two events that they have back to back there at the Rio, for those Star Trek fans who want to go early, that's a great cosplay crossover opportunity, because you and your friends could go as the Enterprise D crew to the World Series of Poker and fit right in, of course, with all those great poker games from the Next Generation. And then you go to Star Trek Las Vegas.
I hear the sky's the limit, Chris.
It is. I also have another cosplay question for you. Have you ever encountered anyone attending a convention as Dr. Trek?
Oh, there was a guy last year. I don't know about what Dr. Trek conjures up, but a guy cosplayed me last year.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes. I met him this year. I'd forgotten he was an engineer at JPL even. He came up to me this year and he'd shaved his own beard. And he goes, sorry, no cosplay this year. It's like, it's okay. It's been done.
And you should have said, no, you're still cosplaying me as Dr. McCoy in Star Trek Continues.
You're cosplaying me in 2013. Wow, what a deep cut. Yeah.
Deep cut.
That's right. Here's my uniform. Walk around and say you're me. No. Awesome cosplays this year. If people go and look at my Facebook Live, there was a tardigrade coming down the hall that I had to stop
and talk to.
There was incredible. And my friend Andy Goldberg, who is a podcaster in LA, comes to our screenings. Did you see this? I'm just going to say this and let everybody go find it. He did a 47 shirt.
Oh, I didn't see that.
But it's like it's not just a static shirt. There's a moving component to it. Anyway.
Okay. Sounds interesting.
Yeah, just am I Larry's Trekland, Larry Nemechek's Trekland, the live videos. There's like six or eight. I did more live video just for fun there, and some real interviews and then some goofy things. And you can definitely tell they're on the run. They're guerrilla. But yeah, that's a lot of fun. The tardigrade is there too as well, and a tardigrade Gorn fight.
I've got to see the tardigrade. Now, when the tardigrade got startled, did it shoot out all the water and curl up into a ball?
No, it was very good. But it did have like a snout that never quit moving. I mean, it was...
Okay.
It looked a little like it was an Eon 3 green... here's a deep cut. Merging with the tardigrade. But no, it was awesome. It's obviously what it was.
Well, they have borrowed some things from the animated series for Discovery. So that could actually become canon, Larry.
Well, let's just hope. Because, you know, the sky's the limit on season 2 on Discovery. So we'll see. We'll see if...
Apparently so. And we'll talk about that also a little bit later. One quick question before we move into the Patrick Stewart stuff. You did mention that this was DS9's 25th anniversary convention, Star Trek Las Vegas. Did you feel that the Discovery, this is the feeling from the ground there, not what we're seeing from
the outside. I know what you're going to say.
Did you feel that all the talk about Discovery plus the Patrick Stewart announcement overshadowed DS9 in any way?
I heard a lot of people complaining about that. It's like no one knew the Patrick announcement was coming. The Discovery, there were a lot of Discovery people scheduled in early. Some of the bridge crew, Emily Coots and Jason. If you were dead or bridge crew, you were set up already. And then CBS, the active cast, the larger active cast came in just here on the last month. But DS9's 25th had been pegged, and with all the Ira and David Zappone about the documentary, that had all been something that was kind of a foundation stone they could lay in early as far as scheduling and guesting, announcing guests. Yeah. But I heard a lot of people complaining that way. And maybe a lot of people were disappointed. Maybe some of that came from the folks who are not exactly enamored of Discovery.
Probably. Yeah.
You know, and the DS9 folks were there. You could go in and talk to a lot of the supporting cast, signing and selling. And, you know, they were just as accessible as ever. And, you know, Bob and JG did the Klingon karaoke at night. And, I mean, there was still a lot of accessibility, and you could see people. And there were still panels, and you can see them. So I don't know what people – I mean, this is the first time in – 12, 13, 14 years, we've had an active show. I mean, a lot of the fandom and a lot of people in attendance have no memory of what it was like to have an active Star Trek. You have to go back Vegas 04, which would have only been 01, 02, 03. That would have only been the fourth Vegas Con back at the Hilton. You have to go back to that point in time when you had an active Trek on the air and a show to promote that was live. So it was odd to me that people said that, but then, I don't know. As far as a head-to-head competition, the lines for Discovery people were big, but it's like, what do you expect? That's the show that's running now. You don't want them there? you don't think people are excited to see that? I saw a lot of, our well-established, that faction of fandom online, right? That thinks it's a whatever. People were taking long pictures, you know, panoramas of the Jason Isaacs line. And when the Discovery people would do, two or three would do a signing at once and take shots of the line. And, so much for Discovery crashing and burning and nobody caring about it. I mean, there was obviously a lot of...
Yeah.
As much as I say, don't take a convention attendance as a snapshot for fandom, I think the world is starting to shift, and having a show on the air and having a fresh face, excited fandom, I think some people had some of their preconceptions kind of thrown back in their face. But... I heard that. I can't tell people not to be upset, but I didn't get that feeling.
I think there are those who, of course, don't like Discovery and they don't like all the attention that it's getting. I also think that as Niners, we've long felt that our show has been sort of brushed to the side because it was sandwiched between TNG and Voyager and such. And there was so much fanfare surrounding the TNG anniversary a few years back that Niners want to have the same thing. And it's
and get out of that
stepchild.
There's
so much more going on right now. You know,
yeah, yeah.
For TNG, it was easy because there was nothing else going on. So yeah, let's just make it all about that. But right now, there's so much other stuff going on that you have to share.
Right.
Just like when DS9 was on TV, you had to share with
that
the
middle
TNG
child
film
stepchild.
Starting and Voyager starting up. So yeah, there's
yeah.
that.
Well, you know, the 25th of Next Gen was a big deal. There was an attempt to have a 30th Next Gen celebration last year that was kind of overshadowed, not so much by Discovery, but just people, there was a lot of, didn't we just do this 5 years earlier, which was
right,
true.
Right.
So,
well, I'm talking about the 25th.
Right. When, the 25th, the silver anniversary.
The fanfare. Yeah.
It was there. I don't know how, if you wanted to go celebrate the Niners in the 25th, I don't know what was stopping you.
Hmm. Yeah. All right. Well, speaking of TNG, let's talk about this Patrick Stewart news.
Wait. What? What Patrick Stewart news? No.
So in the last Ready Room, you and I talked about the rumors that were swirling and the fact that something was obviously happening because there were too many reliable sources reporting mm-hmm. that talks were underway and that something was probably going to happen, but we didn't know what it was going to be. And now that the big announcement has been made, we still don't know what it's going to be because
right.
there's no information. And this is another thing where I want to ask you, because you were there from the outside, I was a little bit surprised by the level of excitement around this announcement because there's no information. And the fact that people could talk, and we did it here on our own network, the fact that people could get together and talk for an hour and a half about this announcement when there is nothing to talk about surprised me a little bit. And I've seen fly by, you know, best news ever and things like this mm-hmm. flying around. And I think it's great news. I'm curious to see what he's going to do, but I'm also not overly excited about it because, you know, I mean, TNG is what it was and the films are what they were. And I remember Picard for all of that, and I don't necessarily want to see him come back unless they do something really interesting with him, which I think they mm-hmm. probably will, given who's involved. So I'm very optimistic about it. But it wasn't like earth-shattering news to me, and I was running out the door screaming excited about it. And so my question is there like a con bubble that surrounds things? Like when you're at the con and something big like this happens, you perceive it differently than the general audience does because you're right there in that moment.
Well, okay, this is good. Two things. So there's a little bit of a con bubble, but again, fandom, I don't want to shock you here, Chris, fandom is not a monolith.
What?
I know. Just trust me on this. Go with me for a moment.
Obviously, you have never been on Twitter. I mean... Because everyone agrees about everything on Twitter.
I've fallen off Twitter more times than you know. But that's a good point, because this is why years ago I realized that we were all so needed. It's a lot like politics. It's a lot like sports. People have different depths of being immersed, right? And there are folks that mm-hmm. stay on their TV channels or their Twitter channels or their whatever, and whoever their chosen news sources are, commentators, whatever, they stick with them all the time, and thank you very much. Then there are a lot of folks who are just fans, and they get, it's almost like it's still 1990 and they're getting their, you know, ooh, it's a weekly magazine and I'm getting stuff weekly. I mean, it's almost like, but that's their life and they're thrilled, and they still come to Vegas to hear the rumors, and they sure did. But mm-hmm. you can't assume that just because I take a sounding in a room. How many of you read the Dead Tree magazine? How many of you are listen to podcasts? And it's like 10%, 8-10% for all of this. So that cutting edge, as much as people are online screaming, yelling, or laughing, crying, whatever it is, that's still the tip of the spear, cutting edge, good or bad. Of fandom mm-hmm. and the great multitudes are there at Vegas, and that's great. And even and then there's all the folks that they left behind, you know, what they left behind. So back home. So yeah, mm-hmm. those kinds of, we have been waiting for this. It was the not so well concealed, obvious leaks, probably from official sources, because there were mm-hmm. so many and on both sides of the Atlantic about a Patrick Star Trek coming. The mm-hmm. the question was, what would it be? Miniseries, series, animated, I'd still love to see him as the superintendent of the Academy show. That would be funny. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that, I think 3/4 of those, I don't know, 3, 4, 5,000 people in that hall, I don't think 3/4 of them had an inkling or had a very wee inkling that there was even Picard talk as serious as it was. Or they might have thought it was just a wild rumor. And like,
maybe heard about it.
Yeah, this is from Variety and Hollywood Reporter. 9,000 security sources have all said this. It's the worst kept secret in history. So that level of it. But there is a little bit of a bubble. But what fueled people for so long, so now those of us out here who do immerse ourselves in this and talk about it, whether they're the other podcast hosts and bloggers and people that make it their business, is, as I started to say a while ago, it's, yes, okay, we knew the Patrick show. And actually, there were a couple of crumbs of reality. He says it will be real time. It will be 20 years, although it's been, I figured, what, 18? No, like 16 years. 2002 was Nemesis. If they do it real time, that's 16 years. But he's rounding.
Although, could his comment be a clue as to when this might actually come out? Maybe it will be 20 years by the time we see it.
Another 4 years. If this sucker takes 4 years after what happened to Discovery getting out of the launch bay, I don't know. I think the all-access accountants and stockholders will have keeled over by then. Don't do this to us again. Talk about fandom. How about the finance department at CBS All Access? The CFO. No, it will be 20 years after. He says, Picard may no longer be a captain. I can't see it. I mean, my headcanon, my fetal Picard show headcanon, is that he's not, it's not going to be pretty Picard in a pretty uniform sitting in a pretty captain's chair in a pretty bridge with pretty crewmen around him. It's got to be, a rogue, or it's got to be him. He's retired, or he's an ambassador. It might be the story that Insurrection was trying to be, only, poor Michael Piller,
Maybe it's a sequel to Gambit, and he's decided to just, join that group permanently. No one would ever expect them to pick up Gambit. But, with the Wrath of Khan, they looked through and they just picked an episode. Oh, Space Seed. Let's run with that. So for TNG, it's Gambit.
Well, it was, in Harv Bennett's defense, it was Ricardo Montalban. He was somewhat charismatic, and it was kind of hanging. Yes, Robin Curtis's T'Lora is going to come running in. They're going to recast that, and she's going to come in and grab him again.
There's your connection into the franchise.
There's that psychic resonator just going to be put together. Yeah. I thought you were putting down the relics, Jean-Luc. I thought you weren't going to mess around with this archaeology stuff anymore. After what happened with your dead professor.
Well, he wasn't dead when he came aboard the ship, Larry. Okay. He died during the story.
Or was he? No. But the storyline, the format, right? And the other thing that I thought of, too, was, Patrick came out. You've seen the videos. That was the other thing. I said, I missed seeing the room, but it's online already. 5 minutes later, 10 minutes, I'm like, it's out there already. And it is. It's everywhere. And everybody and their dogs, little phone camera.
But I still
video.
Think that's completely different from being in the room.
It is. And being overcome by that wave, that love wave. No, I had several things hit me at once. One was, so here's Alex Kurtzman, who pulls off the best intro reveal ever. I mean, one of the best ones ever. He had the great sense to say what he said and then say, and literally say, I'm going to let someone else tell you, which was a great setup and a great surprise. But I just couldn't help thinking, no matter what you think of, Alias or whatever else he's done over there, a lot of people aren't big fans of his work. Some are fine. But when it got to the Kelvin movies and then Discovery even, some people are down on him. But I just felt good for him personally because for once he got to stand there and be sucked in by a love wave, instead of a hate wave or mixed messages. But but again, the fact that corporately CBS to me within 10, 15 seconds, the first thing I thought was, they did wheel Patrick out here. They did do it here. And instantly my takeaway was big with this was CBS is not, it's not so much a shift, but I think it's a maturing. I think that the bench was so sparse. It was just like when they recently had to start a licensing department at CBS after the Viacom divorce. when you've had a big gap, just like you're staffing up a show, people make mistakes and they've gone and gotten some of the Berman era veterans. They could have told them a thing or two, but no one's thinking that. There's so much with, you know, just production design and building and makeup and, oh, the directors and how they shoot the scene, the sets. And, you know, it's a different set, but there's a start. There's the mysteries of shooting in the Star Trek bridge, whether it's 66 or it's 2018. Mm-hmm. You know, those kind of, how do you, you know, doing ship shakes left and right. I mean, all kinds of goofy stuff that people don't know how to do it until they do it and they go through the process. And part of that is promotion, right? And scheduling and what to do. And I just think that CBS has gotten, they've gotten savvier. They've certainly been through the ringer with Discovery. Mm-hmm. You know, some things not of their fault. I say they, I'm talking about everybody who's still there and in charge. And I just wonder if this isn't so much a shift, but it's a maturation and going, oh, I mean, things you and I and a lot of other people could have told them if we had been consulted, yeah. But going, yes, Comic-Con, you have the numbers, you're showing off right. In front of all the other big boys at the table. But it's good. And I don't blame you. The numbers do look tiny compared to that. But there, maybe there are some things that are best suited for Comic-Con. And you know what? I wouldn't have said in hindsight, the Discovery folks deserve their Hall H moment. Because last year, it was so tenuous and new and was. And this year, they've made a splash and they've been through the ringer and they've been able to, you know, present and some of the key things of genre media right now, you know, representation and diversity. And the effects and all of that, the strengths of Discovery and the fact that it's had this troubled launch and it's still here and it's hopefully smoothing out. Mm-hmm. And that they've announced, you know, Alex is going to be the new, I said on Trekland Tuesdays Live, if he's the, you can say he's the new Rick Berman, but Rick only got to do baby steps and he's not the new Gene Roddenberry because Gene never had more than one series. You know, we had the original, mm-hmm. then the animated, then the first few movies. And then, you know, and then the series, barely, the next gen at the same time that Harv was doing the movies and he was tangentially involved there. They, you know, it's not like he was in the driver's seat creating. And so yeah. we've
just to
up.
Clarify for anyone listening who's going, no, he had, you just named three. You're saying Gene never had more than one series to deal with at the same time. Like
Right. Yes. Simultaneous. And yeah. Rick had like baby steps toward this. And we all used to moan in the 90s about, I don't know. Do you think, you know, Rick's famous line was, you can go to the well once too often. Mm-hmm. And I think we mentioned this when we were first talking about the news about Alex getting handed, you know, here's your own center seat, Alex, go staff these shows up and do, you know, miniseries and animated. And here's all these ideas in various stages of development. And I still wonder if the Picard series was that, remember the famous unnamed fourth?
Oh, right.
And a fourth one to be named later, like it was a trade.
Well, actually,
or something.
Yeah, it might be, right? Because that was the only thing that was floating out there that was like, hey, we really don't know what this is going to be
right.
yet. But we really do, but we're not going to tell you until
well, the
Star
people
Trek
reporting,
Las Vegas.
Like one of the two main trades, mm-hmm. Variety and Hollywood Reporter, and Variety had, mm-hmm. here's the four ideas that our sources are telling us, which I'm sure came right from, you know, CBS. And some of them, you know, like the Nick Meyer was known, but the one, Stephanie Savage, the Academy show, was so detailed for that amount of detail for a rumor that was like, well, come on, it's mm-hmm. got to be there. And then I forget the third one, but the fourth one was, you know, one that we don't know about. The animation idea was an animation idea, yeah. And then the fourth one. But on the other end of things, the big rumor from Hollywood Reporter was a Patrick show, a Picard show. And they didn't overlap. It's like the sources that talked to Hollywood Reporter were saying Patrick, and the other ones laid it out that way. And I kept wondering, I wonder if they're telling different sides different things to make it all seem bigger, and maybe the fourth show is the Patrick. We'll see. But then hard on the heels of Vegas, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, was talking about those bigger plans. But, right, not a lot of detail with the Patrick. People were just it took 6 hours for most people just to get over their wallowing in the joy of that announcement, that moment, that mood. And there was a little bit of a bubble effect, but a lot of us immediately, our brains began working on what that might mean. And two mm-hmm. or three other bits to it were, A, people immediately started, after that wave passed, people, oh, well, does that mean he's going to have Riker and Troy? Oh, he's got to have Crusher. And, you know, and people kind of breathlessly going down the list of the next gen crew. if it's a miniseries, I mean, my mind springs to something where he is kind of a rogue or he's on some kind of an underground covert quest. But he, look, he's 77. He's playing him at his elder age. So either he's an ambassador or he's retired. He's out twisting his vines in La Barre, whatever they do. And it's gonna, you know, he's not sitting at the, in the center seat of a starship somewhere. That's, I almost, and that would be redoing.
Well, Kirk did tell him never let them take you out of that chair, but I don't think Kirk meant stay there for 20 years and.
Kirk is a different, you know, Shatner is a different critter than Patrick is. And I think Kirk is a completely different critter than Picard is. And yes, Kirk reflects, if William Shatner ever stops doing projects, I think he's like a wind-up doll. He's what, 85, 87 now? Yeah. If he ever stops doing projects, he'll keel over. It's like, that's what's keeping him going. And
no,
he loves
he's
it.
He's like, now here, Larry, people who have listened to us for a long time, I think know that we're both college football fans. Shatner's like Bear Bryant. He stopped coaching. He said, if I ever stop coaching, I don't know what I'll do. He stopped coaching, and within a couple of weeks, he was dead.
I'd forgotten that, but there you go.
Yeah. And the reason I say that is, I mean, I think you make a good point, because I am always amazed at how William Shatner continues to produce things and is still so vibrant. And I think it is that love of creation. Mm-hmm. That drives him, and as long as he keeps doing things.
Well, staying active and keeping your creative, your creative brain going
amazing.
And all that. But I can totally see the meta to all of this. So the back door to that was people were saying, oh, he can get Riker and Troy and Crusher. And I'm saying it's not just that. When I talk about the maturation of CBS and what they're letting Alex do, Alex may be about to really surprise and redeem. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm an optimist. I always see the best in people. And you know, Alex had been part of the Supreme Court, but there was a lot of committee work done on those JJ movies. And he didn't even work on Beyond. He was,
he was beyond that at that point.
he was somewhere over there out of the light and in the darkness. but he had gotten out of the active Star Trek, which is why he was so available to come pick up the TV mantle with All Access. But I think it's showing an awareness of, and it's also, it's a challenge not only to the creators, because we hear a lot of people say, well, this is great news, except, oh, look, Alex Kurtzman's doing it. So it's going to be, you know, it's like, well, A, let's just hold off. And B, Discovery, as I've said many times, had a very troubled labor, right? If you have a well-oiled machine, as they used to have in the Berman era, if you've got that kind of thing up and running, and if some of these folks, even if you could have saved them the trouble, now they have been through the bumps and bruises before already. So now they can roll out some things maybe a little bit more smoothly.
Mm-hmm.
But if he's his own man and calling the shots, and, you know, Brian called the shots, some of these other things we're going to get to, the Klingon look, the ship look, the all those things were things that Brian called out of the gate that a year later, by the time he left, they were still using. They wanted to, but whether they did or not, that's where they invested a few million dollars,
right.
And that's where they were. So a new Picard show for all – what have people said for 2 years, the people that weren't in love with Discovery? Why don't you just do a post-Nemesis show? And why did we never get – you know, Voyager and DS9 never got a movie. Why don't we get to see them in a movie? Look. It doesn't, you don't have to limit yourself even to the Picard circle, to the next gen circle. You were talking about you wish DS9. This may be the, this can be the entree to everybody from that generation, no pun intended. Yep. All the DS9 and Voyager people can come in and out as, I don't want to see people in clumps like the end of the Mary Tyler Moore show where everybody's like all huddled. Oh, look, here comes the DS9 clump of people through and here comes the Voyager clump of people through. Let them all be individuals, show the strength of the characters and the strength of the Star Trek broad canopy, you know, the canvas. And you can pull some favorites, or let it totally serve the story. And you might see some, they'll have lots of new characters and lots of young faces, obviously. But he's 77. Another thing to think about is this could be Martin Sheen on the West Wing, because Patrick had, he was talking a year ago about having vertigo and maybe not in the best health. And he didn't exactly come out and do push-ups on stage, but he looked in great health. But he is 77.
Yeah.
And TV hours can be grueling 16, 18, 20-hour days. So part of the show will be structured for that. And if it's, you know, that's why a mini series or an even shorter limited series looks right. like the format to go. That's a practical thing. Unless he's surrounded by 20 or 30 characters and he's a Professor X among, you know, all that. So that all factors into it. But just watching how CBS unspooled this and, mm-hmm. and what's at stake here, what can be used, what can be, the characters that can be used. But the fact that they chose to do it this way and have Patrick come out, and it's like as much as everybody loves their Voyager characters, their DS9 characters, their Enterprise characters, you do a poll, any of my rooms, I do a poll survey. The one unifying focus is still Next Generation and the original series. And the original series folks, unless it's Shatner somehow, and who knows what'll happen crazy, but, here comes the Nexus! Oh, it's got both of them now. but that, you know, what other one single unifying actor slash character, if you wanted to hang your hat on a revival of this, could it do? But what it also does is puts the pressure back on all those fans who said they wanted a post-Nemesis, you know, let's see those characters again, yeah. feature or series. Be careful what you wish for, Lieutenant. You may get it. And even if they do say, oh, but Alex Kurtzman and his group's producing it. Yes, yeah. but we will see what happens. We'll see what happens.
Well, I mean, I have a few things on my wish list now. Of course, in terms of who you could bring back, it's a great point that you could bring back anyone from DS9, anyone from Voyager, anyone from that time period. As long as they bring Leffler back, you know, I'll be happy with that. But I also want to see, like, I want it to be a case where...
She's probably not an ensign anymore, Chris.
Probably not. Although Harry Kim might still be an ensign.
Chris, I don't want to break this to you. Robin Leffler is no Harry Kim.
This is very true.
I knew Robin Leffler. I served with Robin Leffler. Robin Leffler is no Harry Kim. Yeah.
I also want it to be a case where whatever it is that Picard is doing these days, in the evening, there's a bar or a lounge where he goes and he has a drink to unwind, and Avery Brooks plays piano in that lounge every night. That has to be part of the show.
You might see a hologram from his Vegas concert from 3 or 4 years ago, maybe. Yeah, Avery's pretty much taken out of the active. Avery was talked about being actively consulting with Ira on the documentary, but he's not going to be on camera. Yeah.
But Larry, you've seen the captain's documentary. Don't you think if someone said, hey, Avery, all we want you to do is just sit over in the corner and play piano, don't you think he might agree to that?
I think, yes. Oh, sure. Yeah. And wear his little Benny Russell vest and spectacles. And
Oh, that would be great. So, okay, rolling back for a second before we move on, one other point about the maturation of CBS and the way that they did this presentation that I think you're getting at with the comparison between San Diego Comic-Con and Star Trek Las Vegas is that I believe that CBS is beginning to understand the importance of the fan base versus the importance of just media attention because... like you said, in recent years, they have done these things at Comic-Con because there are so many people there and the media is there and they can get a bigger splash on the news, perhaps. But Star Trek Las Vegas is where the Star Trek fans are. And by doing this in that setting, they're really saying, look, we understand that you guys in this room, you're the ones who we really have to cater to here.
Right. Comic-Con. On one hand, if you're at Comic-Con, you're at the big table with all the big boys and you're showing up with all the media there. But at the same time, you're at Comic-Con with all the other franchises there and all the media.
Right, right.
I mean, you're only one slice of the pie. You can control, and it's a licensed show at Vegas. So you can set the tone. You can corporately, you know, not take it over, but you can dictate how your people, I mean, there were still a lot of the actors out getting out. A lot of them had, you know, Rekha Sharma, Mary Wiseman were both voices now announced in Star Trek Online. They did panels. Mary Chifo joined Marina Sirtis with some of the women doing the women of Star Trek. So it's not like CBS is keeping them in a box and letting them out on the little Discovery leash there. Doug Jones was doing his own thing, and a lot of the dead cast and some of the bridge folks were doing their own thing. But there were, it was hard to find, Anthony Rapp and Wilson Cruz both appeared with other Trek actors at the Gays and Space Diversity Party Night. So they're letting them out of the box to go and do things, but it was hard to see them on the floor without at least one or two CBS handlers. Yeah. It struck me too that within a year or two, that was probably going to pass because they're still feeling beholden to the show. And after another year or two of feeling their way along and getting in a comfort zone and having more and more clout before they can cut, and the show and the new wearing off a little bit and getting on their own. So that was still all there. But that's the thing that you have at Vegas that you cannot do at Comic-Con. Yeah. And you've got, instead of having a slice of people, you've got all those millions of opportunities to take the selfies, take pictures and hashtag and all that and get things trending. And melt down Twitter with Patrick Stewart and Picard is back.
Well, I do like to think of it, though, as them understanding their relationship with the fans a little bit better. Because one thing that I see so often in social media is how CBS doesn't care about the fans. And I think that that's not true, but I think that there is a misunderstanding amongst some fans about the fact that this is ultimately a business, as you and I talk about on this show quite often. And therefore, CBS does approach it as a business. They have to think about the money that's invested and what they're going to get back. But I see a bit of a shift from that back towards the fans a bit more. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to see that.
Well, and yes, we've said that for years. I've said that for years. And the other thing, and this takes me back to the old Paramount days, is that we say CBS this and CBS that. It's just like fans used to say Paramount this and Paramount that. It's not a monolith. There's Paramount, there's production, there's whoever is in charge of production. There's publicity and media relations, there's licensing. You know, now we've got home media, home entertainment. There's events. They're not competing turfs, but they all have slightly different agendas and slightly different pecking order. And, you know, licensing may want to do something, but they've still got to get somebody in production, whoever's producing, like the actual onstage folks. They've actually got to get in sync with that. Or media relations may want to make a big deal over here with some mainstream media outlet, which would be great numbers. And whatever licensing has got promised to licensees, you know, I mean, there's all of those things. There is no one big monolithic, especially when it comes down to these things that fans see on a level, especially on a personal level, face level, you know, and then producing After Trek or any of these ancillary things that filter down to where people, sometimes it's people's biggest touch point to the show or in the big corporate picture of things, it's this tiny little thing over here to the side. And that's what big corporations make the mistake of anyway, especially with entertainment and branded things. They forget that things on the flow chart that are tiny little boxes may be the biggest thing to somebody who's going to blow up Twitter, right? Or Facebook the next day if something goes wrong. And I think it just took these kids to grow up. I think they're learning how to steer, Chris. I think the kids are learning how to steer in the Star Trek realm and the Star Trek universe, which has really not been there, even with the JJ movies, the Kelvin movies, and Paramount, because features come every 2 and 3 years and personnel on all levels turn over. That's the big thing between films and TV. And when you're doing a series and people are there for a time at a time, back to the old days, the Berman years, you had people come and go, but there was a lot more continuity and feeling, and people had been around for a while, and they learn and they apply the next year. And
there was a bit of unprecedented continuity in the Star Trek franchise over that 18 years.
Well, right. We got a little spoiled. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, the folks that just monolithically say CBS this and CBS that.
Well, Larry, you'll also notice in social media, some of the most vocal people who don't like Discovery and what's going on with Star Trek will still point out to you how Paramount is really screwing up Star Trek on television, because they know it so well that they don't realize that that divorce happened and that CBS is in control these days.
You remember when I said that maybe 80% of the room had not been following headlines closely? Yeah. So anyway, you cannot take that joy away. But yes, I kept wanting to say, Oh, again, the biggest news to me wasn't that it was there, but it was how they did it and where they made the announcement and how they did it. And then we were off and running with.
Yeah. Okay. Well, last thing to talk about on this, and then we'll talk about it again in the future when we know more about what the story might be, is who's involved. Now, you've mentioned Kurtzman many times, but he's not the only one involved. The concept itself is reportedly the brainchild of our friend Kirsten Beyer, who is a writer on Discovery, but is also the woman behind the wonderful Voyager novels for quite a few years now. And that's one reason that I'm very optimistic that they're going to do something very interesting with this concept.
Right. There's a sandwich effect here, starting with Kirsten. And you know what? Kirsten was, I mean, some of the decisions that Brian made out of the box, I wonder about now, like the Klingons, like this, you know, but it was Brian's decision to bring Kirsten in because no one had ever had a book person come in. And Kirsten didn't just write Voyager books. She was known really well for bringing the entire Trek canon and being able to use people from the other series as if it's real life and people leave ships and crews and get new assignments. And she was able to employ not just the leads, but, you know, the backstory so much past, you know, and the other crews and the minor characters and the guest star bits and pieces, as well as all the authors do a great job at that. But Kirsten, Brian brought her aboard. That might be his greatest, you know, gift to the franchise in the long run, might be the fact that he brought her aboard. Now, she's obviously in a place where, our friend Ted Sullivan from Carter Hall, at Carter Hall, credited her in this think tank of being the one that generated. And, you know, it could have been something as simple as they're all sitting around one day and go, Patrick wants to get involved. What would we do? Or even if we're doing a second show, guys, what should we do? And maybe somebody said, hey, you know, all these people that say go back and do the post-Nemesis, you know, let's do exactly that. And maybe she's the one that voiced it and had some ideas, and then it took off. And then the CBS All Access people said emerged from there. But also in this circle, so Kiva Goldsman is not working on Discovery, but he's involved, also being listed as involved with this. And James Duff, who just came aboard kind of to fill the Aaron Harbert's Gretchen Berg hole here, whether he's the showrunner and Alex is looking out over the whole shingle now, or whether he's a 1A and Alex is being very hands-on. But he's involved. He's an executive producer. And then what really perked up my ears was we'd had the news at Comic-Con about Michael Chabon, Pulitzer Prize-winning author, who was doing one of the short treks, and he's going to be either an executive producer or someone high up. So there's an ongoing. They love having Oscar winners and anybody that can get involved with another title from outside Trek to show that. But he's, you know, big, huge Trek fan who also happens to be a very hot novelist. So it's got a great pedigree. And the bottom line to all this, and what I was starting to say on the ground in Vegas when I got the, yeah, but Alec Kurtzman's doing it. Look, the bottom line to all this is Patrick did not have to do this. Sir Patrick did not have to do this. He is 77. He had the attitude that I've done as an actor, even, you know, like I'm turning down money. I've done all I can with this. It's going to be repetitive. I want, you know, and it's an actor's, in 2002, it's an actor's thing about, you know, getting away from a character I'd like to develop. Well, he's developed Professor X. He's done lots of stage work in Shakespeare that he loves to do. He's had all the time in the world to do that. And he's still active. And as I was saying, he's showing that he's in pretty good health now still. But the bottom line here is I don't think Patrick Stewart has pretty good instincts about looking out for himself as an actor, looking out for the material that he tackles, and looking out for his clout and the power that he has when he gets into a project, and especially when he's going back to the thing that gave him this comfortable life where he's not still down in the West End doing Shakespeare, as glorious as that was. So I have a feeling that if he's involved, if he's one of those noisy actors with clout that's involved in the otherwise circle of producers and writers, he's going to be looking out for his character. He's going to look out for that era and that universe. And if they start bringing some of his beloved, you know, cast in, even his cameos, and some of the other actors that he knows well from the documentaries and from the con circuit and, you know, working with them, it's almost, you were talking about Kirsten being in that circle. The fact mm-hmm. that Patrick is in that circle, and will have, I'm sure he's contractually obligated. I mean, that's the status he had with Nemesis. He had, you know, notes approval. He had all kinds of approval rights and input and a certain level on his standing. He's at least going to start there now. It's had 16 years for that to to mature, mm-hmm. you know, the interest to accrue on that. So he's starting off there. So if nothing else, that's what I say to fans who are worried and wondering about this, that yeah. Patrick himself is going to be there and sounding off if he doesn't like something or trying to steer some of those conversations.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't need to do this. So if he has agreed mm-hmm. to do it, chances are they have a concept that we're going to find to be good and to be interesting.
Right. And as Ken Ray, John's co-host on Mission Log from the Roddenberry Circle, noted in our panel that we did like a half hour after this, we were trying to assimilate all this with our normal topic, which was the power fandom. He brought it back around and said, look, Patrick himself cited, and everyone can see it in the video, he said, I thought I was done with this, as any self-respecting actor would say in a franchise, and I don't want to get mm-hmm. too stuck with it. But he basically said between the fandom that didn't go away, the fandom that kept clamoring for more, and Patrick being a very political animal, looked at how the world has gone the last 3 or 4 years and thought about, you know, truth, justice, and the Federation way and everything that Picard mm-hmm. stood for and put all that together. Fan demand and the world at large, as we said, still could use a lot of Star Trek, and what better person? Again, no slight to any other casts and characters, but my God, so many people were so shaped by The Next Generation growing up, and Picard is that person.
Picard as a leader inspired so many people,
right,
including
right.
me. And so, yeah, people really look up to him. And I think that he can be a good voice in these
things. Because I don't think money is an object at this point.
No, I don't think that's an issue.
Right, right. Anyway, there we go. We'll see. Of course, the proof will be in the pudding, you know, so we'll see.
Speaking of whether money is an object, let's talk about this news about the Kelvin Timeline films, what I call Kelvin 4, because Star Trek 4 is yes. the voyage home. Apparently, the actors, who I refer to as Chris Squared, Chris Pine and Chris Hemsworth,
glad you got your whole code worked out on this, Chris, because it's hard
to
say.
It all there.
It's hard to say Arabic 4 and Roman numeral 4 in verbalizing it.
Yeah. Well, I've got it there because, you know, these two Chrises are frequently confused mm-hmm. when it comes to films. If I'm not mistaken, it is Chris Hemsworth, who hosted Saturday Night Live a couple of years ago and did an entire monologue song sketch about how he is not Chris Pine. So it's perfect that it right. works together here. But anyway, Hollywood Reporter is saying that the two Chrises are walking away from the table in negotiations for the next Kelvin Timeline film, which mm-hmm. would have, of course, featured Chris Pine as Captain Kirk, but also would have included Chris Hemsworth as Kirk's father in some sort of time travel story. So how do you do a movie that is supposed to feature Kirk and his dad when the two actors who are known for these roles in this rendition of Star Trek don't want to be in the film?
We're going to see your CGI General Organa and and raise you a Kirk and Kirk Sr. I don't know. The first thing when I see that story is, A, my dad taught me to walk away from the table when I'm buying a car.
Okay.
You know, it's a negotiating tactic.
Yeah.
I remember at one point hearing the rumor and gossip, and someone told me in the art department back when Nemesis was being made that Michael Dorn couldn't come to terms and he was going to walk away from the table. And then, of course, he wound up being in it. And that was a different time and scale and place. But this ain't over yet, right? The Fat Tellarite has not sung on this saga. We'll see. We will see what happens. But it's also quick to say this story in the reporting is that everybody else in the cast are expected to close. So if the movie was really going to blow up, I mean, yeah, it's hard to imagine how you do a Kirk. I mean, I'd love to see the Bones and Spock Chronicles or something, but it's hard to see how they would do a movie without them. They're pushing ahead on doing the deals with everyone else. We will see. But the bottom line to all this is I am so glad, as much trepidations people have with Discovery. I'm so glad that it's happening. The Kurtzman era may be upon us, and other iterations and forms, short form. I'm just so glad that the public perception and the Suits and the Bean Counters perception, who are not fans, that all of that is not hanging on how these one-off Trek movies do or are received. I am so thrilled that there is a Trek franchise beside these, because now these can go over and be hits. I don't want anything to be a bomb. It can be middling. It can be great. It can blow the roof off the box office barn. But whatever happens, it's not the end all be all to how people perceive Star Trek today.
Yeah. Well, reportedly Beyond grossed $343 million worldwide, but it cost $190 million to make. And there are some reports that the studio actually ended up losing money on the film when all was said and done. I don't know if that's true, but obviously a $190 million budget for a Star Trek film is really something when you think about the TOS and the TNG films that we got in the past. And the fact that $343 million is considered a lackluster performance shows where movies and box offices are these days. You know, I think you could recast Hemsworth and it would be fine, because it's not like we got a lot of George Kirk in the 2009 movie. But of course you can't recast Chris Pine and have someone else play Kirk. I don't think that would work at all. I think at the end of the day, they'll come to some kind of agreement and they'll make this film.
I do too. It's watching pro athletes negotiate for what they can get, knowing that they're only going to have a short, playing time. And the clock is ticking and all this. And this is the fourth movie. So they had the three picture deals. This is the first time they had to go in and negotiate options separately from the original, 2007 contracts, that long ago. Yeah. So, but again, I'm like, okay, fine. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. I'm just so glad that I'm not on the edge of my seat worrying, not worrying directly about the film, but worrying that that's what the world at large is seeing. What's interesting about Beyond, I don't have the numbers exactly in front of me, but people talk about how the trend line on the box office was, 09 came out. And can I just say, by the way, when they first announced that the first JJ movie, Trek movie, was going to be called just Star Trek, I did groan. I said at the time, we are, it only been a few years, 4 or 5 years since I had to edit Communicator. And I said, by God, we finally got it to where Star Trek in italics was the name of the original series. Star Trek in Roman was the name of the franchise. Why the hell did you do this to us?
I still have to fight that battle today, but yeah.
And I said, we're just going to call this Star Trek 09. That's its name. That's what we're going to, and here it is 10 years later and everybody still says Star Trek, or they just say 09. I find myself saying that. Well, in 09, which is confusing, but if you say the O in front, you're okay. But the trend from 09 to STID, which I still enjoy saying, instead of Into Darkness, the box office trend line was up. And then on Beyond, there's a tendency to say it was down. Actually, what happened was the Beyond, the U.S. box office was down. The global did go up from, the world did go up from Into Darkness.
Well, I think in Japan, I believe it doubled, actually.
Wow.
I mean, the numbers are small. Like, off the top of my head, I think it was 5 million for Into Darkness and 10 million for Beyond, which is nothing in terms of, U.S. box office.
Right,
for Japan, that was pretty good.
Well, and now that Netflix is, globally showing, with the exception of Canada and the U.S., Netflix offers Discovery around the world. And I know, the old historic big foreign markets were Australia, Germany, and the UK, outside of, Canada. We don't ever count Canada. Canada's just just there. But the true foreign markets,
I'm sure that Brandon Shea Mutala will be thrilled to hear you say that, Larry. So will Dan Gunther.
Yes.
Just see if you get invited onto the Edge or Literary Treks ever again.
I'm done. We'll find someone else to talk about stellar cartography, Larry. Sorry. You're out of here. No, and I just had my first Canadian Portal 47er sign up at Vegas.
Wow.
So, no, I'm trying,
but,
really
but
not trying to
there,
insult them.
Larry.
They're just there. They're just there taking up all that pink space above, it's on the globe. It was always, Canada was always pink. stretching all the way to the North Pole. But no, I mean, Germany, Australia, the UK were the big three foreign markets.
Right.
And then it really dropped, and they're different population bases, but after the US, Canada, then nothing else compared to that. All the countries not just were smaller, but the proportion of, you know, and that was basically because of the original 1970s decisions by programmers in simpler days of not just TV, but in foreign, you know, networks and state-owned networks. And if they treated the original series like an adult show and showed it at night, it had a bigger fan base. Most of the world would show it as a kiddie show, like on Saturday morning or the equivalent. And that was the public. So that was the public foreign perception grew that way for 20, 30 years. And 09 trying to be any of the movies going out. But then when they really ramped it up again with 09, they were having to fight that. And that's why, if you remember the movie promotion, they were doing premieres. And it's like, my God, they've moved from, you know, from Bhutan to Nepal now from the next world tour, you know.
Right.
They were really trying to build to break through that and bring Star Trek into the get away from perceptions of the past. But it's amazing how the decisions that people did in the simpler days, how that still drives the markets and the popularity. It's still the UK, Germany, and Australia as the biggest foreign markets, like you said, like Japan. But there's been a lot of inroads the last 10 years. That's another thing the Kelvin movies have done, is at least bring Star Trek to some of those markets. And now Discovery is there with Netflix, and I'm sure Netflix is benefiting from that, you know, cutting from that pioneering work. But it sure wouldn't have been that way, you know, 15 years ago.
Definitely. So we'll see what happens with this movie. Do I care if they make the movie? Not really, but I think they will make it. And I'm always up for another Star Trek story, whether it's in the Prime timeline or the Kelvin timeline. So we'll see what they do. I did just rewatch part of Star Trek Beyond a couple of nights ago. I watched the first 20 minutes of Beyond. I really love the scene between Bones and Kirk.
The bar scene.
Star Trek Beyond, the bar where they're just sitting there together.
It's very whiskey. It's very Pike know? And that was one of the two moments that they showed at the now I call it the May 20th, but when they tried to springboard the promotion for Beyond from being so late starting. That was at the night in LA. That was one of the two extended scenes they showed.
Yeah.
And at the time I was like, my God, this is Pike and Boyce talking in the opening of the cage.
Yeah. Yep.
You know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I wish the whole movie had maintained the feeling of TOS that we got for the first 20 minutes, but I do enjoy the Kelvin movies, but I don't have the same passion for them as I do for the Prime timeline stuff, obviously because I grew up with the other stuff.
Well, to me, I grappled with this for years because I didn't want to knock them, and they're well done. I mean, there's, you know, you can always critique them, but they're not badly made.
No, they're well made.
And aside from saying, I think the cast is one of the strongest things about it, and knowing that for millions of people that was their first Star Trek, and you never diss that. But I finally realized that by not being Prime, I'm not just being anal fanboy here. It's like it doesn't matter. It doesn't fit.
Right.
Since they didn't expand that universe, it doesn't matter. It's nice stories about fake people. Let's get back to Prime where everything matters, you know?
Yeah, you're not emotionally invested in this version of Star Trek.
Right. It's kind of like, well, that's nice.
There's not enough of it, and it's duplicating something that you are already emotionally invested in.
Thank you.
So, even on
level of the debate about will they ever do another follow up, say a new Star Trek The Experience? Well, that was then at the time when, you know, DS9 was there and the 23rd century, the 24th century shows were all uniform. But it's like, if you sat down to do a live experience like that today, what would you do the bar on? What would you use as models? At the time we were talking about 09, there's nothing. What, you're going to do the Iowa bar from Riverside? I mean, what, except to go back to Quarks or at least like the K7 bar and do it like 60s. But what is there there's nothing familiar outside the bridge from that universe that people would think, well, this is cool to go and see and be part of experientially.
Oh, from the Kelvin timeline.
From the Kelvin timeline. Or the Kevin timeline.
Well, there's a lot of interesting stuff in the Kevin timeline, Larry, but we're waiting. We'll talk about that on another show. I was going to say they could do the mess hall from Discovery because, I mean, that's
right.
quite an
well,
atmosphere.
Well,
right
I was
there.
Talking about the discussion. Yeah, and I'm not I was talking about – I should have said this. I was talking about the discussion pre-Discovery.
Yeah.
I'm talking about coming out of the Kelvin films. Yeah. What did you live with long enough to be memorable and heartwarming for fans and tourists?
But Larry, you know, in the Kelvin timeline, the Star Trek experience never closed down, so they don't need to open it up again.
Chris, we have to get Star Trek 4 made. Come on, Chris Squared, get back to that table.
All right, let's move on to another topic. Discovery is going to be available on media, Blu-rays and DVDs. And Larry, sit down for this, okay? I've got to tell you something. You're not going to believe it. You have to pay for this.
No. Damn it. You know, my grandma and grandpa used to tell me about getting all the old Star Trek VHS tapes for free.
I know, right?
Well, actually, I'm kidding. Yeah. They used to have the wax cylinders, you know, the... They would sit at home and record them on their own. They'd put the Victrola, you know, elephant, the eggplant thing up to the radio and record their own audio. Yeah.
I see. Yeah. Because, see, my grandparents were sketch artists. And after they retired from working in courtrooms, they used to watch Star Trek and just sketch the scenes really, really quickly.
Wow. Wow.
No, Larry, whenever I hear people complain about having to pay for all access so that they can watch Star Trek or have to pay for anything else with Star Trek, I think back to the fact when I was in high school, I used to go to the bookstore and buy individual TOS episodes on VHS tapes for about $15 an episode. And I did it, and I built the collection. And now we're complaining about paying, what is it, like $7 or $8 a month to watch a new series and also have access to all the old stuff. So... times have changed a lot.
You know, and I mean, I know things are different for people, but yeah, people, I love fandom, bless their hearts, but it's like people find the wherewithal to get to Vegas once a year. And that's not cheap. Yeah, that's expensive.
That's very expensive. Yeah.
And you know, it's like, well, guys, if you just did with about $20 less a night on your meals here, you know, or whatever, didn't buy that one. Don't let me tell you to not help out one of our vendors or one of our licensees, but if you just cut your cost by, you know, $40 or $50 for your big, you know, $1,000 week in Vegas, you could.
Or like maybe don't buy a copy of Stellar Cartography.
Now, let's not get carried away, Chris. Especially not while we're in the pre-order time of $50 from Amazon Direct before October 9th.
Larry, that's 6 months of all access right there.
Yeah, that's right. See? No. I prefer to take it out of the fat of a big, fat Vegas week. Let's not trim into the lean meat here, Chris. Let's not do that. No, I mean, you know, I understand where everybody's coming from. Everybody's going to deal with their own lives. But yeah, now I've done December at the beginning of the break and also like February at the finale time. I did a survey in my newsletter list. And by the way, everybody, LarryNemechek.com, can get on my newsletter once a month. I don't spam you. And I haven't done it in 2 months, so I really don't spam you. But we ran a survey about how people were with Discovery, and including, you know, wrapping in the attitude about All Access. It was really more about All Access. And I had a strong 8% or so that said, I really want to watch it. I hear everybody talk about it. I'm not going to, you know, it's not such a waste it, but I don't want to put it into the ether. I can't keep the all access. I will spend it on hard media. I'm waiting for the Blu-rays whenever they come out. So there's a chunk, and I still see that kind of percentage reflected. So here we go. What I love about this is just like what we've been saying all night already. This is exactly what we thought. It's coming out for the holidays and is a promo for season two, and you know that's how they'll package it. And now we've got the.
Yeah.
Gee, we didn't see this coming. Yes, we did.
So I pre-ordered mine just right before we started recording.
Oh, okay.
And on Amazon right now, it's $47.77.
It's how much,
Blu-rays.
Chris?
$47, huh? Coincidence? I don't think
yes.
so. and $41.99 for the DVDs. So the Blu-rays are, well, if you signed up for All Access just for the run of Discovery, the Blu-rays cost you more than it would have cost you to just sign up for All Access and then cancel at the end of Discovery.
Yes.
But of course, the flip side of that argument is that you do have physical media now, which you own, and you don't have to keep paying in order to have access. You know, I get Discovery on Netflix because I live in Japan, and I have Netflix for other reasons besides Discovery.
And you're making the American listeners angrier and angrier, Chris, as you say that.
But so for me, you know, I'm not paying every month just to maintain access to watch Discovery again if I want to. I'm using it for other things. So you can make the argument of, well, let's wait for the Blu-rays, let's wait for the DVDs, and then buy those, and then I can watch it as much as I want, and I don't have to keep paying month after month to maintain access. And that's a very valid argument. So it's good that they're going to be available on November 13th for those who want to do that. And the other benefit to it is that you get extras. There's going to be two hours of special features. There's the concepts and casting of Discovery. There's one called The Star Trek Theme, which is a discussion with Kurtzman and Jeff Russo, the composer, about the Discovery theme. And that'll be interesting because Jeff Russo was just on our Star Trek music podcast, Melodic Treks, with Brandon Shea Mutella about a month ago talking about the theme. So I'll be curious actually to see what he talked about with Brandon and then what's on these Blu-rays. And see if maybe we got a little bit of scoop on anything, maybe.
Yeah. Jeff has done Comic-Con. He was at Vegas this year. In fact, there was an amazing concert that Dennis McCarthy and Michael Giacchino and Jeff Russo. So you had like Berman era, Kelvin Verse and Discovery composers and the chief lights of the composing world co-conducting and co-running this concert. But Jeff Russo is a huge fanboy. Huge Trek fanboy, and he did a documentary piece about what it meant for him to stand up there and record the new theme and have the motif in there from the original series. But one good thing, the way that After Trek has been produced, and as active as CBS has been in promoting, it's the era of having to do online promotion, social promotion. But as those things popped up, especially on After Trek week after week, I was like, well, look, they've got the DVD Blu-ray set done. All they have to do is pull off. You know, or half done. There's so many features they produce there that they've got tons of, and this is bonus, and this is beyond that, but they had so much produced. They've done a really good job. I could tell they had cameras there. It's 2018, not 1966, and it's sure not 1984 or 1990, but they've had cameras and video and doing this from day one, so we're not sitting down with people 5 years from now, right, looking back. They've had people there in the moment doing all kinds of behind-the-scenes live video. So good on them, but it's kind of where the world is. It's what the world's been doing since the DVD bonus feature era, you know, dawned. But yeah, 2 hours, they say. They say 2 hours of all of these props, costumes, makeup, visual effects.
Food.
Yes, the on-set food stylist. And I feel sorry here for Dorothy Duder, who's Doug Drexler's other half, who they met while she was doing food for the Berman era shows. She never, well, maybe she did finally get a DVD. Someone's going to let me know that. But I was just thinking, I'm glad to see that. I'm glad to see that going there. And a female producers and writers, looking at Discovery's women. So there's one for 2018 and one on Gersha Phillips. So yeah, it's 2 hours of features here.
Plus extended and deleted scenes, which will be interesting to see what kind of gaps might be filled in by those things that we speculated about. I'll also mention, Larry, because we talked about Jeff Russo, Michael Giacchino, and Dennis McCarthy also recently did interviews on Melodic Treks with Brandon. So tune in. If you're a music fan, check out the show.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to this, definitely, and having Discovery, even though I can watch it when I want. On Netflix, I always like to buy media of things that I love, whether they are TV shows or movies or albums from my favorite musicians. I buy almost everything digitally these days, but there are those particular cases such as Star Trek, Star Wars, They Might Be Giants for music, people like that I want to support. I always like to buy the physical media, so I did pre-order these.
that giant EMP coming in the future is just going to have us all leaning on our hard media. Yeah.
That's right. Well, let's talk about one more thing regarding Discovery to wrap up the show today. And this is Discovery Season 2. We got the teaser trailer. And we got a few bits of information also from Star Trek Las Vegas. One of them being the fact that Dr. Culber will be returning, which I always suspected, even after the way Season 1 ended. Those who listen to Notes from the Edge, which is the show that I do where I share my take on Star Trek Discovery solo and make connections into the larger franchise. When the uproar happened, when Culber was killed.
Is that capital letters? The uproar? Capital T? Capital?
The uproar.
Yes.
Yeah, it's capital a capital U. T and a capital U. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's actually a Wikipedia page for it already, Larry. The uproar of, yeah. But at that point in time, I said, look, Culber, he's probably not actually gone. They'll find a way to bring him back. And even as Season 1 ended with him still deceased, I really didn't think he was going to be gone. I think that relationship between Culber and Stamets is too important to what Star Trek Discovery is doing. And it is Star Trek. People can always come back. And Wilson Cruz has confirmed that he will be coming back. And in an interview that he did with TrekNews.net, on the floor at STLV, he said, "We're aware of the responsibility of being the first gay couple in the Star Trek TV franchise. And because of that, we take it very seriously and we take this relationship very seriously. And we're responsible for what's being put on the screen. After my character was killed, that was the end of a chapter in their story. That was not the end of their story. It's a long book. And that was chapter one. We promised you guys an epic love story. We are delivering an epic love story. To say that I'm excited about what we've already done and what we're about to do is an understatement. It's everything that I'd want it to be." So there's definitely going to be more. And the writers were not trying to send a message. They weren't trying to kill the couple because they were a gay couple.
Yeah.
As so many fans screamed about, you have to let creators tell the story they want to tell, and you have to be patient.
Right. That's what I shouldn't say this, Chris. I'm losing my newfound, renewed connection here with CBS. But what actually happens is that losing Culber is what motivates Stamets to go in and perfect, just sort of like just weapons training, perfect what becomes the holodeck. And so, he had some personal hollow screens of his husband, and he, it's the Stamets Culber love affair romance is what leads to the refinement of the holodeck is what really we're getting to here.
And I see.
I'll
check next week in Larry and see if that's on Memory Alpha.
It always is. I'm surprised it'll be right there on their uproar page, the uproar page. Yeah.
So I'm glad to know for sure that he's coming back because I really like what they're doing with Anthony Rapp and Wilson Cruz and Stamets and Culber.
They enjoy each other,
obviously. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really good part of Discovery, and so I'm glad to see that returning. I did want to ask you what you think about this concept of Pike taking command and centering a story in Season 2 around Pike leading the Discovery crew to unravel a mystery that apparently involves Spock in some way. What do you think about that, you know, as someone who grew up with TOS and is such a big fan of the original series?
Well, what have I said since I was, 15, 16? Hey.
The Tellarites are your favorite aliens.
Besides that, Chris. That and McCoy don't get no respect. Those two things. I was big on Underdogs. I've told you that. No, it's like, okay, fine, but what have you done for me lately as far as all these people that didn't want prequels and, you know, yada, yada. It's like, no, it's filling in the time, filling in the gaps. So look, I thought one of the most organically powerful parts of Discovery, and I have not gotten off on, as folks know, I don't ship, and I don't get off on the characters. I love I love a good story. I don't like a bad one. You can tell in your bones when something is gelling. And to me, just watching the show unroll, the biggest surprise and the biggest heartfelt moment to me, a lot of people were upset about, you know, cramming, I'm quoting, air quoting here, cramming, you know, Michael into the Sarek family, Sarek and Amanda and Spock. And I would say, well, you know, people did the same thing with Cybok. Yeah, I know. And I never liked that either. It's been 30 years. And it is a little odd, but we do have this caveat that Vulcans are weird. You know, Spock and Sarek, Spock and Sarek, bear with me. If you didn't know that, I'm sorry. Vulcans are revered. Vulcans are sexy. The first alien, you know, Vulcans got Star Trek renewed. Vulcans gave Star Trek a future because all the women who were love Spock were the first zine writers who made clubs and conventions and bang, bang. Okay.
Vulcans gave us Velcro, Larry.
Oh, and most of all, forget Star Trek franchise. Vulcans gave us Velcro. And
that impacted real people's lives.
That's right. Yes, and spacecraft and astronauts. Vulcans got us the moon in a backwards kind of way. People don't know that, and it should be noted. That should be the gift right after the uproar.
That's right.
Another new Wikipedia page that Memory Alpha can do next week. People forget that Vulcans are weird. Spock and his dad didn't talk for 18 years. Vulcans, my favorite go-tos here are Vulcans, after 200 years of contact and 100 years of Federation co-founding membership, never told the central database about Ponfar. I was like, what? There are Vulcans on cruise and they didn't deign to tell anyone about this? So, you know, and you can go on down the list. There's all kinds of wacky, goofy things that Vulcans did not inform everybody off planet about.
They're a secretive people.
They are a secretive people. Well, that's what it, didn't you count? That's what I meant when I said weird. Weird equals secretive. That's what I thought.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, that nuance didn't come through. But the episode where you get that, and we all know, you know, Sarek and Spock didn't talk because for 18 years because Spock chose Starfleet, not the Vulcan Science Academy. What I think the most powerful moment for me on the shipper level, on the relationship character level, but also canon also, and I think the most masterful job they did of actually finding some organic points of discovery to lay very logically, no pun intended, that emotionally and logically laid into all existing canon was the moment when you found out that Sarek tried to manipulate the Academy, the Vulcan Science Academy, for Michael, and they wouldn't take her. And basically said, look, you've got two twerp kids. You got a half human, you got a full human, you're faking as a Vulcan. I mean, there were very, there were some lingering bits there from the pre-Kirshar reform moment there.
Yeah, right.
And basically what it had to be. They're being prejudiced there. And the fact that Sarek, when he tried to hold the door open for Spock, he held the door open for Spock rather than hold it open for Michael. And then when Spock, you know, turned it down, he realized he had cost Mike. I mean, it very organically fit. It was like, wow, what a great way to thread the needle and have something impactful. So rather than the whole thing about nobody talks on Vulcan and nobody shares anything with Outlanders, Offworlders, I can totally go with that. If it worked for Cybok, it worked for, you know, Sarek is married again and has another human wife. I mean, he's an odd bird to begin with. And then Vulcans as a people, just in general. So on top of that, I can get it that she was a foster child raised in the family and then went off and had this history. But to have found this focal point in time here where he manipulated the system away from her to favor Spock, and then Spock didn't take it, and he screwed it up for both of them, basically. I just thought that was one of the most original, organic, and I just went, whoa, that's a really wonderful layering on of a new layer that permeates and resonates back. Now when you go watch Journey to Babel again, or even the scenes from, I mean, if you're sitting around with nothing else to do and you're watching 09, but when you watch the Sarek moments or, you know, the come together moment at the end in 4, It just, it adds all of that to it, even though they're not running around going, but Michael, mm-hmm. I don't want to go on about it, but it's,
But it's a good point. Like, if you were bothered by it at the start of Discovery, I get it. But after Lethe, after those events, if you still were just bothered because of the fact that we didn't know that Michael was part of this family before, at that point, I think you're just being a gatekeeper, and you're not mm-hmm. you're not actually taking in the story that's being told, and the fact that we don't know what happened during this time period. So,
right.
And as you say, the Vulcans are very secretive. So, how that happened.
Yeah. Your original question to me was, sorry.
But as for season two, but it's good that we talked about this, because I think that it sets up the story for season two, where we reportedly are going to see Spock, which means Michael and Spock are going to meet on screen. Now, we've seen them together or read them together in the novels, in the Discovery novels, right. But we're going to see them together on screen for the first time. But we do need that setup. And now, knowing the relation between Michael and Sarek and Sarek and Spock and the events that happened should make it very interesting when we see them together in whatever situation we find them in the second season.
Right. If we're not parsing this as seeing some flashback where we're seeing young versions or something.
Which it could be, right. Yeah.
Just that would be the ultimate horrible tease, but then it would just be the latest horrible tease.
Again, I don't know what they're going to do. Part of me feels like we're probably not going to see a lot of Spock, because I think it would be kind of odd to have Spock be a big part of this series. At the same time, Spock is serving with Pike on the Enterprise, but Pike is transferring to the Discovery, and he's taking the ship on this mission, which gives us the opportunity to see Spock briefly as Spock is left aboard the Enterprise. And I don't know what they're going to do with it, but how do you feel about yet another actor playing Spock in a canon, official Star Trek series?
It's fine. I mean, at the beginning of this, you said, how do I feel about them filling all of this in? It's 10 years of unknown history.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know if they and or Zach Quinto want to set a precedent of having movie people playing themselves on television.
I don't want to see Zachary Quinto in Discovery.
They didn't go back and get Ben Cross to play Sarek, right? That's fine. That's the kind of maturation of the franchise that I'm fine with. You can't have that.
Yeah.
And you're talking about people at different times in life and different ages mm-hmm. and all that. That's fine. No, as long as it's just done well, if every moment can fit as snugly and resonate and add some new richness and texture and oh my godness, as the moment I was talking about the revelation about, poor Sarek, he's carrying around the guilt of botching it for both of his kids at the academy there, or botching it for Michael because he held it open for Spock, who turned it down. If you can come up with that much power, that retconned relationship power through some of these moments to come, that would be awesome. But I did want to say that Anson Mount has talked about this. It's not like it's season two was the Anson Mount Captain Pike show. It's still Michael Burnham is the lead of the show. It's still Sinequa. And he's talking about he's still a guest star for a few episodes. And depending on how they structure these, and they're 5-6 episodes in, maybe more by now.
Yeah.
But he's like saying, I'm not there. It's not a focus on me. It's not a focus on Pike. So let's bear that in mind.
Do you know why he has to say that? He has to say that because the trailer comes across as, hey guys, we know you didn't like what we did in season one, so here's Captain Pike. And Captain Pike is going to come over from the Enterprise, and he's going to take Discovery on this mysterious mission, and I think it might have something to do with Spock. And there's also the other bit of news I want to talk about in just a moment to wrap up. The Klingons are going to have an all-new design because, hey, we know that you didn't like what we did in season one. That's how, when I watched the trailer, that's how it came across to me. Like, hey, you know what? Look at the uniform. There's that gold captain's uniform. We're going to get into real Star Trek now because we know you didn't like season one. That was my reading of the trailer. And Pike is so center stage in what they're presenting. I can understand why Anson Mount has to get up there and say, look, don't worry. It's still, this is like the Michael Burnham show. I'm just going to be there.
Well, yeah, yes.
Now, am I just misinterpreting? Do you think I'm crazy for reading the trailer that
way? No. And that's, there's two levels here. I think, as I said from the beginning, and as things, you know, even before the show premiered, we knew what had been happening backstage. I got to hear a few nuances to that, but basically, you know, my analogy about it's a cross-country taxi ride with three drivers and the car never stopped when they changed.
That sounds like a good movie, Larry.
I've got the rights. No, it's already registered. It's already with the WGA.
That's called Driving Miss Daisies, yeah, right?
Driving Miss Discovery. That's what it's called. But there will be refinements, right? Things will happen and you can come out. But so much of what I think it's like when that train was moving, they could not stop the train, but they had already loaded all the cars with what they had and they couldn't stop and recommit. Glenn and James McKinnon and all of them came out last year at Vegas and came up with all these ornate talks about how the ridged head, they were able to, you know, have almost like bionic or Borg-like implants and the ridges, and that's why they had no hair and all that. But the simplest, I mean, the Klingon look to me was interesting, and you could make a case about maybe they leaned on Klingon language a little bit too much in the first few episodes, although the Klingon speakers thought it was awesome, I'm sure. But the average casual viewer, so some of those choices. But knowing where they were coming from, I could retcon that as species diversity. I think I said that at the time. I would still love, and I was waiting to see the guys in the back of the holographic club meetings, you know, the council, some of the Klingon people that showed up. But the fact that they came up with a number for the Klingon houses and as maybe starting to be the first nidge toward, look, they're on different planets. They arose on different planets. Yeah. They didn't all come off of Kronos. So that's open. The fact that they're getting into that and acknowledging that is just the fact that, I mean, yes, put it bluntly, they're coming back. But I don't think it's part of it is they acknowledge the fan reaction. But I'm going to go off on a limb here and say I'm going to think some of that was some of them who have been old fans were excited to come up with new designs. Yeah. It's that creative, you know, that I talked about before.
Okay.
But I think they were also responding to marching orders from Brian and other people at the beginning. And now I think it's a second year. They've had some of this retcon platform laid out there, and now they can fulfill some of it. And it's not just that, oh, the fans are beating down our door. Quick, hurry, let's change this. I think they may have internally wanted to do this, and if nothing else, just be more creative, be more diverse, and you know, and fulfill that.
Are you talking specifically about the Klingons, or are you talking about the Klingons plus bringing, you know, explaining the uniform differences, for example, by the fact that the Enterprise crew has these new uniforms that are colorful.
Right.
That, you know, well, I mean, how Pike and his gold. And
yes. But I mean, they're still not. Okay. Two things that the anal folks will, but are canonistas would say and I answered this in my canon fodder topic in the Dead Tree magazine, Dead Tree Media magazine about two things. The uniform, the cut is still not simple 60s cage cut. Or original series.
Well, you couldn't do that.
So it's that. And also that operations, engineering, communications, and all that should be tan. It was tan in the cage. It was tan in We're No Man. So you would think, oh, well, between 2223 or 2254 and 2265, ops was tan and it changed to red. And I came up with the idea of no, there was the two windows we saw in the two original series pilots were the time when that one admiral guy who really held out for tan got his way twice. But if you go back to Archer's Earth Starfleet time, it was red, right? For Trip and for Malcolm.
Right.
So really, ops had always been red, except for those two times when Admiral Mr. Tan supporter for ops got his way twice with Starfleet Quartermaster and they replicated it for everybody.
Because one of the other admirals was sick and missed those meetings and couldn't override him. You know, I mean, and the other thing is maybe the Enterprise just got a bad shipment of uniforms. They were the wrong color. They had to wait for a new shipment to arrive. And those two stories took place while they were waiting for the new uniforms to arrive.
I see. You've been doing some overtime too. I mean, yes.
These things happen.
He was a, that wasn't a badmiral. That was a tanmiral. See?
A tanmiral. Yeah. Yes.
It's that guy. No, I can just see the guy at the corner office who's like running around. Like he's got to show his turf, and he's like, "No, damn it, I like tan. For engineers, shouldn't be in red. You can't put security guys in red. They'd be like a moving target. No one ever listens to him. They're sitting ducks."
Actually, he might have been smarter than we think.
I know. See, then finally, 100 years later, someone said, "Maybe he had something. Maybe we should get those guys out of the red."
So about the Klingons. I think there are two ways that you can look at it. In an interview with Trek Movie, Glenn Hetrick, mm-hmm. the makeup designer, was talking about what they're going to do in season two. And he said, as we move into season two, it has been a while since we have been with our characters. It has been a while since we have seen our Klingon friends. So everything keeps evolving. The story has evolved. And I can guarantee you this. You're going to be blown away that they have a completely new look yet again, going into season two. Look, I'm going to pause for a moment because if I were him, I would not have added yet again. It's like drawing attention to it. Like, we know that there's this one species in Star Trek that we keep changing over and over and making you angry. But no, I get what he's saying, right? Things evolve. But then he goes on and he says, in season two, you're going to see much different designs. You're going to see different houses mm-hmm. you haven't seen before. One of the most important things to us was that at this point in canon, as we head towards the current version of unification, the houses really each grow up on different planets. It is an empire. It is not just Kronos. We have seen six of the great houses in close-up in season one. As we move forward into the next season, I promise that we will continue exploring and unpacking and unfolding that infinitely interesting story of what the Klingon culture looks like on a wider level. So this goes back, Larry, to what you and I talked about on the Ready Room when Discovery first started. The fact that we only saw six of the houses.
Hey, wait a minute. I only saw six of them on that empire.
That was the title of the episode. Yes. I only saw six of them, guys. You know, we said at the time that maybe the other houses that we aren't seeing look like the Klingons we're familiar with. That may very well be where they're going here, although with mm-hmm. an updated look, some kind of revised look. But I've thought all along that the story that Discovery has been trying to tell with the Klingons is that it is a fractured empire.
Yes.
And there are different groups and there are different houses that follow different traditions, and those traditions can affect appearance as well. Do they have the long hair? Do they have no hair? So when I said there are two ways that you can read this, you can be cynical, as I was kind of joking about earlier and my take of the trailer. Even though I took the trailer that way, I was also being cynical about it. You could say that, well, they're reacting to fan response and they're saying, okay, you don't like those Klingons, we're going to make some new ones. Or the other way to look at it is, this is part of the plan from the beginning. And in season two, we're going to see Klingons that look a bit more familiar to us because that's where the other houses are.
Right. Look, Chris, I remember. I think the year was 1984, and Star Trek III was coming out, and the world had changed. The world of visual effects and shooting for movies had changed so much. When they built the model, I mean, there was no ILM when the motion picture was made. And when they built the original refit Enterprise model, it was big and heavy, and it was, you know, made to film on. And just within that 3 or 4 years, visual effects and techniques and tools and materials had, you know, we're light years beyond where they'd been in the late 70s, and the industry was fractured, and motion control, computer run motion control had come so far. And the ILM crew dealing with the original refit model for motion picture, it was heavy, it was bulky, they hated to shoot with it, they hated to use it. It was expensive and it looked great, and they couldn't change it. And one of the reforms, all of those, you think about how many models were designed and built for when ILM really took over and had been more established. Mm-hmm. So even from the Wrath of Khan, those 2 years, think about 80s movies and what was going on in Hollywood and the revolution in visual effects. And when they built the, they designed and built the Excelsior model, Harv Bennett, in the early comments about it, and I heard him talk about it at a convention later that summer, one of the first times I was, you know, getting where I could travel to other states. The original idea was that the Excelsior look would replace mm-hmm. the Enterprise look. And part of that was, and I remember seeing interviews with the effects team talking about, oh, how they said, how we hate the model. What I didn't realize then and what a lot of fans didn't realize then was he wasn't talking about he hated the design. He hated the physical miniature that they were having to work with. But it came off as like, oh, we're the new, it's what we see all the time. We're the new guys and it's hot and sassy now and this is old and we don't care and we're having to clump around with it and we're having to deal with it and we'd rather have something new and the Excelsior is all new. So it sounded like the Excelsior was going to take the place of that. And by the time that, even on slow motion 1984 standard, pre-internet, you know, paper and stamps internet, by the time that permeated through the fan base in the 6-9 months of the production of the movie, people were already saying, don't you dare, don't you dare. And of course, in Star Trek III, the Enterprise is blown up, and the original idea was for Kirk and crew to go over to an Excelsior ship. Well, the plot of the movie kept them off a ship, you know, as they went to Vulcan and had the Bird of Prey. But the original idea was to do that, and there was so much fan pushback against it. Not only the fact that how dare you not have a Constitution, you know, refit class Enterprise to be an Enterprise, but there was so much revulsion against the Excelsior as a lead ship. They called it the pregnant guppy and the flying guppy. Okay. So the original intention went out the window, but by the time 3 came out, I specifically remember Harv Bennett saying in St. Louis, what do you think of the Excelsior? I mean, he was saying, yeah, it's, you know, nothing could ever replace the Enterprise. They had totally changed. There'd been so much fan pushback to the point where in 4, when they're coming, they're in space dock and they tease you. Well, they said they're giving us another ship, right? And you're having the shuttle conversation.
Yeah,
they even tease you by seeing the Excelsior first and having Scotty say that line about that bucket of bolts. That was specifically a tease for everybody that thought they were going to be having an Excelsior and a throwback to that fan pushback. And then, no, dum-da-dum, here's the slash A or hyphen A.
Yeah.
So that was one case that springs to mind where an intention was completely, you know, people started off on the run down one path and fandom rose up and spoke and said, no. But they
No, you don't.
And so the Excelsior class was, and the Excelsior became the butt of the jokes chasing it, right? That didn't help either. But, that was a case where the original intention, you know, went out the window but with a retcon, with a polite kind of label that you have to go back to the originals. You have to go back and look at some early conversations. And that's happened a million times on a million different, you know, props and sets and costumes and all kinds of things.
Yeah. Well, whether these new Klingons that we'll see in season 2 are a retcon going back, trying to course correct because of fan pushback or not, we may not know for sure. But at least they did leave themselves a nice opening by only showing us 6 of the houses in season 1, easily going back and being able to give us more.
Well, and if you think about, so the whole political Klingon, the backstory they came up with here from Archer's time for, remember how primitive Kronos looked at Archer's time? It really looked like a medieval, I mean, it was like you didn't have the spires of First City that you had, you know, by Picard's time, and never saw it in Kirk's time. We have now, this or 10 years before, we've seen it in the late 2250s from Discovery. But when they went there in the pilot, and maybe one other time, it was a much humbler, you know, the Capitol buildings and all of that, the council buildings were much humbler, and the council room was. So the idea that they had been, I mean, it's the comparison is all the Muslim and Arab tribes all over the Southwest, all over the Middle East, and why they were after the biblical times and the height of the Arab and Muslim empires, right? And the height of their science and math. And then for a millennia, they were split up. They were subjugated. The Europeans came in and, you know, had them all as colonies and protectorates. And it's just been the last few years, they've had a kind of a rise of nationalism again. And I think, and some of that was meant to be some of the metaphor there. So that Discovery was trying to do. So I totally get that. And I think it's pretty, I think it's part of why the Klingon look didn't bother me on the surface so much is because I could see if you really mind that kind of texture for backstory, remember, texture, not trivia, that I thought it was really rich. And the fact that it's only six houses out of the 21, they've totally left themselves open to eventually get around to that. And not just how these makeup designs looks, but look, Laurel is supposed to be Chancellor of the Empire, and we know that Ajit Bor succeeded her father, but that could be like the old thing of, oh, the senator died and his wife's going to be senator, but nobody would have ever voted for a woman out of the gate, right? And and the thing about the Duras sisters and women being on the council. I mean, there's at times, it's like, no, there's no other, never a woman in power unless she's Elizabeth the First or that one woman that stands out in some power structure at a time in some great empire over time. So I can totally get that for the Klingons, but now we're only 10 years before Kirk. We never saw ruling Klingons in Kirk's original series time, and not until Gorkon, right, in 6.
Yeah.
So the whole soap opera of did the houses that rallied around T'Kuvma at the beginning, were they all punished? Were they all put down so much that the Klingons that we came to know, you know, whether they were augment virus intermixing, you know, with on the Federation border, or what all that backstory is still out there to play with. And
right.
And can actually be used for not as fan service, but can be used for storytelling. And what happens to Laurel and her house, and why do we not see those? It could be sad and tragic why we don't see, you know, the heavily ridged and bald Klingons could go from in power to out of power, out of favor.
Right. It will be interesting to see what they do with it. They've played around with that, not these specific Klingons, but the smooth head Klingons we know from TOS and the ridged Klingons we know from TNG and onward. They've played around with that power structure in the comics. And so that's not canon, of course, but they could do that with the Klingons in Discovery. I'm interested anyway to see where they go. Well, Larry, it's been fun talking about all of this news from Star Trek Las Vegas. And of course, as we always do, speculating on what we think might happen and how it plays into the business side. But it's not the only thing we've been talking about on the network recently. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
Can I just say one parting shot about the enemy? And this is just something that annoyed me in the episode. It has nothing to do with the Romulans, but when Geordi's down on the planet and he detects the neutrino beam, he says, "Wesley Crusher." And I think, how would you know that? Like, no one else on the ship is smart enough to have thought of this. And it just really irked me.
And you know, Geordi's been on the ship with Wesley for a couple of years. He knows that if Wesley's around, he usually saves the day. So,
yeah.
But yeah, he is jumping to a conclusion a little bit. Could have been like, Reg Barclay. That was him.
To the journey!
I feel like they missed an opportunity to put the Talaxian fur fly in Neelix's medicine bundle.
I think the fur fly is a little large to go in the medicine bundle.
It's more like a medicine backpack.
Yeah, that fly is huge. That's something you'd see in, like, if you play video games, you would see that in Fallout coming at you instead of a blood bug.
Yeah, the fur fly is the state bird of Talaxia.
So is it a bird or is it a fly? Which is it?
Standard orbit.
There's 4 volumes of Batman the Animated Series. The first 3 are pretty much the same season. They added Robin and they changed the name to The Adventures of Batman and Robin, but that's still the same animation style, same voice cast, same creative direction. Then there was a bit of a break, and they revived Batman the Animated Series called The New Batman Adventures. Changed all the animation. Most of the voice talent was the same. But the story quality was just... It's kind of like a third season of TOS. I'm so proud of myself finding all these parallels.
The 602 Club.
I totally agree. He is... I love... It humanizes him, because Professor X, we've seen him as the stoic teacher who can do no wrong, very wise. So to see him kind of in this sort of, like, you know, youthful, kind of very energetic, very It's just a fun character, and you get to see him develop. I think one of my favorite sequences in the film is watching him, the montage where he's teaching the kids how to hone their mm-hmm. powers, and just him being in his element like that. And McAvoy really sells it. I mean, a lot of the dialogue in this film is a little cheesy, and it's a little stilted at times, but there's not a single moment I don't believe him.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us everywhere you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. And if you have a moment, please leave us a star rating and a written review. We'd love to hear what you think about the shows. And if you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, most third-party apps, or you can go to the website and stream or download the MP3 file. We have so many ways for you to get our shows, so check us out wherever you get your audio. And if you'd like to let us know your thoughts on today's show, Larry and I would love to hear from you. There are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join in the larger conversation is the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right on up. And if it doesn't, just type the whole name, the Babel Conference, and you'll find it. It is a closed group, so if you're not a member yet, you'll need to click join and answer two simple questions, and then an admin can let you into the group. And if you'd like to send us email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that will come to me by email. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our username is TrekFM, and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. So, Larry, we have joked a bit today about stellar cartography and why maybe people shouldn't buy it, but I think they should buy it. So tell us about that and tell people where to find you, all the stuff you have going on, and what's happening now that the two big conventions of the summer are over.
Wow. Yes. So stellar cartography, it's a big update. It's the same basic, wonderful big maps and the guidebook, except that we've done 2.5 things. We've completely updated for everything from season one of Discovery, with two major exceptions that the producers wanted to hold on to. But we've got everything located, including the Mirror Universe, because as you, of course, you know, everything in the Mirror is in Prime. No planet. We know of no Kelvin planets that have blown up one way or the other and complicated things. So Romulus is still there. So everything you heard about in Discovery, we've located all the star bases from not just Discovery, all the new ones, but also all the original and animated star bases. We have the Klingon War included, the animated graphics for the battle lines that they came back from Mirror and saw advancing. I've meticulously made those work.
You know, since they actually used your maps in the show,
yeah,
it's like coming full circle,
it is.
Right?
It
like
is.
Bringing it back around.
It's awesome. Yeah, I Instagrammed this, and you know, and our friend John Van Sitters at CBS was great. I knew what happened, but we finally had a conversation about how he had shipped, and not only the writers had them to write from, but they sent them to the art department in Toronto. Mm-hmm. And they're still kind of been in their ivory towers. I look forward to getting to meet more of them when they can talk more and come up for air at the same time. But yeah, it's been awesome to see, you know, and you know, that's on the shoulders of everything that Jeff Mandel did in his book that I've worked with. And then the modern look based, of course, on what Mike Okuda started with The Price in TNG. But all the way back to my first impetus out of the tech manual and then the 1979 maps. So it's like whatever I do in Trek, every so many years, it seems like the star maps come around, the stellar cartography. Mm-hmm. So the new ones are out October 9th. Oh, and we also fixed the Klingon. We had Levin Letower, who did all the Klingonese subtitling for all the Netflix countries, who's a Klingon speaker. We've got our all Klingon map is not only updated, but the title block and the titles actually read accurately.
So you guys did not get the Klingon subtitle option in the U.S.?
No.
On CBS All Access? Oh, really? Okay.
That's what's been funny about that. Yeah. So
I took some screenshots of it and tweeted them, I think.
And everybody's like, "What? Out, so, what is this?" So that was awesome. So no, we updated the history where we needed to, Alpha and the Beta and the Klingon and what I always called the kitchen sink map or the National Geographic map. Mm-hmm. And they've all been updated for the war and for all the place names, with two major exceptions, which will come along later. A year later, we could have done that. But now that we're going to have new Trek all over the place, I'm hoping that we'll be on that treadmill of having to update. So, you know, how often can we do this? So it's out October 9th, but please, please, everybody pre-order now, because not only is it cheaper, it's like 2/3 the cost, but it's just like everything else these days. The clicks, the likes, the pre-orders not only affect this one, but they affect how the perception is about maybe doing some other cool outside-the-box projects.
The last release, eventually they were all gone, right? Now if you try to buy them, aren't they quite expensive?
Yeah, they've gone into collector's prices. Yeah. So
yeah.
Which kind of and make
so if
sure
you want it,
yes,
get it now.
And just so if you go on Amazon or eBay, you can still buy copies. You'll think it's crazy expensive. Well, that's because you're buying a 2013 edition. It's kind of greenish, so I always make sure to tell people to look for the pinkish nebula on the front. If you really want to avoid a problem, just come to LarryNemechek.com, go to my store, and use the link at my page. It would be really cool if you did that.
Now, is this kind of like the Murasaki Nebula from the Galileo 7, which Murasaki means purple in Japanese, but it's actually green on the screen?
I didn't know that. Well, it is. No, this is the Pepto-Bismol Nebula, as seen when you shoot a Klingon in null gravity.
That was
strange. No, but just look for the pink. Everybody, pre-order if you can now. But no, otherwise, thank you, Chris. We're also about to debut the Geek Nation Tour, big LA to Vegas tour for next year before Vegas. So everybody, if you want to be on board for that, you can go to geeknationtours.com or just write me, Larry@LarryNemechek.com. I'll make sure you're there. And I'm about to unveil my own day tours in LA called Trekland Treks. So that's happening. But most of all, aside from our visits here, I'm on Facebook Live every week, Tuesdays at 1 o'clock Pacific on Trekland Tuesdays Live. And again, like we talk here, I try to take a step back, get out of the hysteria of the moment on the internet, or maybe take a side tangent that I've seen in my own observations. And then we look at the parrot analytics, which are increasing, the TV streaming ratings that are out there. And we have live talk back. It's on Facebook, so people can talk to me, and we talk back live that way. And it's archived. I'm up to episode 65 next week, which is kind of amazing.
Wow. Already. Wow.
So that's that. And of course, the Trek Files on the Roddenberry Network come out every bite-sized, adjustable 20 minutes. I know people are amazed.
And of course, those are also available on Trek FM in the master feed.
They sure are.
Also on our iTunes artist page, you'll see them there.
And thank you for having us in the master feed at Trek FM there, along with Mission Log. And, about to come up on the 4th anniversary, starting year 4 of Portal 47, which is kind of amazing.
Wow, are you serious?
We launched in 2015. I know.
I just remember our conversations when you were choosing a name and doing a logo and all this stuff. It's been 4 years.
It's kind of crazy. So I threaded the needle and got 15 or 16 of our Portales who were just in Vegas together, and then we had a meetup there for newbies to come in. We had more folks coming aboard there. So, so a lot of things happening in Trekland, and I really enjoy it's odd because now I'm having people come up and thanking me for the Trek Files, and somebody last week even said thank you for Trekland Tuesdays Live, because it comes on right when I'm making dinner. And I'm like, oh my gosh,
that's awesome.
That's incredible. Yeah, so.
And then if you miss a week, they're like, I can't cook a dinner. Why is that here?
It's Tuesday. Sorry, guys. Sorry, kids. No Tuesday dinner. I can't do it. So it's been awesome to watch all this stuff kind of. I may eventually pay my bills now or something again. But
well, that would be good.
That would be good. Right. So no, that's all. So that's all going on. One real quick thing I wanted to mention that was set up at Vegas was a new thing at Roddenberry, at the main Roddenberry site, is the VR virtual museum with Sanspar. And the people from Second Life they're digitizing a lot of artifacts from Gene's computer files like ships, but also a lot of artifacts from Gene's personal life. And they're going, they're bit by bit, they're growing. And It's a virtual life, so you can go in and have a character persona meetup. They've done mission logs on a couple things there, but it'll be 24 hours. You can bring a VR headset, but you don't have to have one. You can just come and enjoy. People hang, they're going to get it where they can have screenings, you know. So you're watching a movie or a TV show as your virtual character on the virtual screen, but it's the Star Trek that you know. So that's interesting. But that's a whole new thing that Rod's doing to kind of get more of the Roddenberry files and assets out for fans to enjoy rather than having the thing there and have to haul it out for a museum or a convention or something. So, and live, I'm going to be for, this is the third year, on a 3-night library tour the evening next week, August 14th, 15th, and 16th around Greater Detroit. Chris, again, Tuesday, August 14th in Rochester Hills at 7, and Dearborn Heights on Wednesday, August 15th, and Northville's Library, August 16th around Greater Detroit. And then after that, of all things, I'll tell you about it later, I'm going to be at Sputnik Fest. Sputnik Fest in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, which is near Green Bay, on September 7th and 8th. And then I'm really looking forward to being at Northeast TrekCon in Albany, which is October 26th, 27th, and 28th. That's all I know. There might be some other things besides that, but for right now, that's what's on the thing. I really look forward to hopefully seeing some folks live.
You never take a break, Larry. You're always on the go talking about Star Trek. And then if people just want to tweet at you, which of course they love to do, that would be at Larry Nemechek.
Pretty complicated, yes.
All right. Well, if you want to catch me, if you want to tweet at Larry and me at the same time, which people tend to do after the Ready Room, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. That's my username pretty much everywhere in social media. You can also find me there in the Babel Conference on Facebook. And elsewhere on the network, you can find me doing The Orb, which is our Star Trek Deep Space Nine podcast, which I co-host with Matthew Rushing. We just put out a new episode recently. We're making our way through the mirror universe of DS9 right now, and we are 3 episodes in. So check that out if you are a Niner. And also, as I mentioned, I do Notes from the Edge, which is a sub-show of The Edge, our main Star Trek Discovery podcast. And I only do that show when Discovery's on the air. But if you're doing a rewatch and you missed it the first time around, after you watch each episode of Discovery, go and catch the corresponding episode of Notes from the Edge to hear my thoughts on this story as it unfolds. And also what I do primarily on there is I connect the dots between Star Trek Discovery and the greater Star Trek universe. So you'll find that in the feed for The Edge here on Trek FM. And if you want to read my writing about Star Trek, you can find that over on the official website at StarTrek.com. Now, Larry, I'd like to take a moment and thank our associate producers here on The Ready Room, Renee Roberts, Zachary Fruling, Sam Piasek, Kay Elizabeth Shaw, Tim Robertson, David Shuford, and Ju Kim. Thank you guys so much for your support of the show. You help keep The Ready Room going and everything that we're doing here on Trek FM. And if you listening would also like to become a supporter of the network, you can do that through Patreon. It does take quite a lot of money to keep our shows coming to you each week, all the different shows we have here on Trek FM. And if you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can get all the details about how you can help. Perks include early access to episodes through our special website, Patron Zone, exclusive content, producer credits, such as associate producer here on this show or another of your choice, and all sorts of other things that we do from time to time through Patron Zone. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, check it out at patreon.com/trekfm. Well, Larry, I've got to go back and start up my campaign to get Leffler on the new Picard series, so I'll have to chat with you later.
Well, Chris, it's time to stick a really, really rusty Resican flute in it, because the Ready Room is done.